G'day everyone. It is another Friday. It is another Friday afternoon. Sounds like a Friday afternoon. And it is another week of yet more things. It's always things every week. So I hope everyone's doing well in your respective parts of the world. I did have this sense of sense of a great amount of fortuity wandering around the shops and so on today. I've got a new hat. Wandering around the shops and being able to get around life as normal. And I know it's far from that in many other parts of the world at the moment. So I hope everyone's sort of making the most of their own lot in life wherever they are. I notice my good mate Scott Helm seems to be making the most of his lot in life in the UK by buying an off-road buggy, which I think is an excellent choice to just go and be an irresponsible man-child for a little while. And not jealous at all. Beer of the day, because I always get asked, is 7 Mile, which is from Ballina, which is not too far that way. Ballina's probably about an hour that way. I don't think I'm allowed to go there at the moment because it's in a different state. And also they've got daylight saving and it's just messes stuff up. West Coast IPA. It is actually really, really good. So, is a good way to start the day. Start the day, end the day. Where are we? It's been a very long day. I'll come back to that in a moment. Let's look at the comments here. Good morning from Stavanger. So funny story. I was literally just talking about Stavanger about an hour ago with my partner, Charlotte. So we had New Year's Eve in Stavanger last year with our good mate, Noel Merrigan. Some of you know Noel, Irish guy living in Norway, thinks he can speak Norwegian, apparently sounds very strange, which I imagine an Irish person trying to speak Norwegian would. But yeah, we had New Year's Eve in Stavanger, and it was the sort of weather that you would expect on the west coast of Norway. And for those of you who have not been there, that basically just means rain, certainly at that time of year. And we're just planning where we're going to be for New Year's Eve this year. And we know it's going to be hot, and we're basically just deciding on like how hot it's going to be. And we're saying, well, that is a very, very different environment to last time. Christian, which is your favorite Norwegian beer? I can picture the can in my head. It's got like a nice colorful gradient. It is an IPA. I'm sure if I check on Untappd, it's in there. I tell you what, when I remember, I'll let you know. I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to get it here. But I did spend it. Norway's a kind of funny place, actually, in terms of things like beer, because it's like you can't, and Christian will tell me if I'm wrong here, but you can't buy beer from like a supermarket on a weekend, or you can't buy it after like 4 o'clock and they put like the shades down on the beer fridge so you can't get it. And then they've got this, Christian will tell me the right word, Vinomopolis or something like that, which is like a government-funded bottle shop, as we'd call it here, where they've got a whole bunch of different beers and drinks and things like that, but then there's a really, really high tax on it in Norway. Now, that didn't stop me drinking beer in Norway, don't get me wrong, but it is a premium luxury pursuit when you're in that part of the world. All right, I'm sure we'll talk much more about beer, if not today, then many other times yet to come as well. A little bit of normal housekeeping stuff. First sponsorship this week is Vronus. Vronus was last week too, I think. Vronus has been there for many weeks before. They're still talking about Security FWD, a brand new YouTube show from Vronus, episode 1 on how far Wi-Fi can travel is up there. And as I've said many times before, Vronus is one of these organizations I have spent a lot of time with in the past, in person, physically. And now we just spend time together online. But a great organization, and I really appreciate their ongoing support. So good on Vronus. And just whilst I'm talking about support and organizations and people I'm spending time with, I am doing a keynote at the Arcos Lab Bankrupting Fraud Virtual Summit on the 10th of November. I'm going to put a link to that in my notes later on. There is a registration page. It's a public talk. You can go along and see that. And I quite like the way they have positioned this in terms of bankrupting fraud. Like, how do we make fraud no longer feasible? So I'm going to have to think of many insightful things to say before we get to the 10th of November, but I've got a little while before I have to think about that. Now, just noticing a comment here as well. This is going to be one of the next things I talked about. There's a comment here, good morning from Johannesburg. So the Johannesburg in South Africa has been on my mind. In fact, part of the reason I'm a little bit tired today is I did do a keynote last night, very, very late at my time. Now, I'm going to tell you exactly what the name of it was so that I don't mess it up. Because to be honest, when I do these events, and don't get me wrong, like I have a lot of fun at these events, but very often it's like, it is like one thing after another. I follow my calendar and I make sure that I'm ready and then I go and do the talk. And particularly when it's remote, if it's the Cloudflare one I did recently or the Arcos Labs one coming up shortly, I'm still going to be sitting in this environment looking at the camera. It's going to be pretty much the same levels of engagement. But the one last night was actually super, super cool. So this is a South African company called Intellect. So Intellect had their Dev Day 2020, which is an internal conference, but lots of people tweeting out externally as well when I did the talk, so I assume it's okay to talk about it. But just a super, super cool company in terms of the way they're obviously engaging with people. I saw a little bit of their internal cultural material, and I think I'm okay saying this, but I said I'm going to take this and show my 11-year-old son because this is the kind of place I would love you to go and work one day because it was just such a cool setup. And I think they did a really good job in very difficult times of actually having sort of an online community involvement where everyone had a bit of fun. And it wasn't just like, welcome to another WebEx. That was, I enjoyed talking there anyway. So I did that. And another one I think I can talk about because people did tweet it out. I did do a workshop during the week, which I'm doing a lot of remote workshops at the moment, which I was doing well before COVID as well. So I got a little bit of lead time to be able to prepare what a remote workshop looks like. In fact, I wrote about running remote workshops years ago now. And when I do these workshops remotely, they're the same thing that I'd do in person, except I'm here. And I take a two-day workshop and I break it into four half days. And I do the half-day thing in part because it makes it a lot easier for time zones. So this one was a whole bunch of people in Europe. I'm just not sure whether they tweeted where they're from, but let's just say Europe. So that was like 6:30 to 9:30/10 p.m. for me each night. And then I've got some more to do week after next, which will be in the US. And then it'll be like 4:30 in the morning, my side till, well, what does that make it? 10 a.m. or something like that. So there's that. And the other thing in terms of splitting them in half is that I find it's much more taxing for me and much more taxing for participants when you're sitting in front of a computer versus in a classroom. So a full sort of eight-hour day, with me looking at that and then other people looking at me does get a little bit tiring. So lots of workshops going on, lots of keynotes and conference talks still going on. It's just that I don't leave home and I'm not jet-lagged. I'm just tired because I went to bed after 1 a.m. this morning. So a few other things here. Good, IoT, shiny dog. I've been suffering your pain with IoT. What a complete mess. Very elegantly put. I have used different words to explain it recently, some of which I won't mention right now. I did carve out some time this week to really start diving more into this blog series I'm writing. So I'm writing a five-part series, and I literally had this 27-inch monitor was like part one, and then the big ultra-wide here I broke into three parts, part two, part three, part four. And then part five was on the other 27-inch monitor there. And I'm just like looking around going, holy shit, this IoT stuff is a mess. But I am documenting a heap of stuff. IoT things that I've done in the last week include just this morning, I finally set up a bunch of automation so that my external Ubiquiti cameras can start to turn on lights when there's movement, which is good. And I think I've got all the motion sensitivity and motion zones on those pretty solid now. So I saw nothing come on the last few nights inadvertently. So I was getting stuff like spiders setting it off. We got a lot of those here. But that seems to be okay now. The humans are setting it off correctly, which is good. So now I've got things like if it sees motion and the sun has set, the light will come on, say, out the front, and then there's a separate rule which says if it is after, I think I said like 10 p.m. and there has been no motion for 5 minutes, turn the light off. And it does it that side and it also does it on the back side as well. So that's pretty cool. And then I tweeted out this morning asking for any suggestions for good IoT buttons. So what I was after is at the moment I've got an automation which is turning on a whole bunch of lights around the place for an evening scene. Now, I used to turn it on at sunset, but I've realized the place is actually dark enough a bit before sunset. So I've got like an offset in there now. So before sunset, turn all these lights on. So the garden goes on and the pool goes on and the fountain goes on and the front lights and things go on. But then when we go to bed at the moment, it's kind of a mess because there's all these light switches. So I've created an automation, which is like bedtime, and I can fire that up on the phone, which is fine, but I want to have like a kinetic button. So I asked this morning and the resoundingly positive feedback was all for Xiaomi Akera switches, which is good because things like these little motion sensors that I've got laying all over the place, they're Akera, as are the temperature sensors I've got, as are the proximity sensors that I've got to see when the doors and things are open. And they're Zigbee based. They use standard batteries, which last about 2 years. So I'll have a button and I'm not sure if I'll put it like downstairs before we retire upstairs. Sounds very fancy. Or whether I'll put it next to the bed or something like that. And you'll just push it and it will fire the automation and then like everything will go into night mode. So that bit's pretty cool as well. I'm kind of happy about that. Now, looking at the comments here. Good morning from Romania. That's cool. I still haven't been to Romania. Probably not going to happen this year. Maybe another year. I've just been looking at your Shelly store because of you. We'll wait for the blog post. So I did spend a bunch of time on the Shelly's today as well, trying to work out. I'm in some sort of an odd edge case at the moment where some lights you can't turn off with the physical switch that have got Shelly's behind them. So you're meant to be able to either switch them off digitally or switch them off kinetically with the physical switch. And this has like been the absolute heart of my UX objectives. I still want simple things like switches to work the same way they always did. So if my mum and dad are over here and they're like, oh, it's a light switch, it must turn a light off. I want that to actually turn the light off, but I also want it to work digitally. One of the things I'm struggling with at the moment is that when someone not familiar with the IoT nature of the house comes in, so say it's the cleaners. I get a cleaner in once a week to clean and they like vacuum and do other stuff that I'm not very good at. And they turn off the light switches in the kids' rooms, and the kids' light switches are connected to, they've got four downlights on the ceiling, which are all IoT. And normally I trigger them on and off digitally based on things like motion and time of day. So they've been turning them off, which kills the power to them all, which means you now can't turn them on digitally because they've got no power. So I've got a Shelly behind my daughter's light switch. And I think what I'm going to do is that if they turn off that switch, I might put a label on it saying, don't turn off the bloody switch. But if they do turn off, because it's got a Shelly on there now and I can see when the Shelly has the power killed, then I can get the Amazon Echo to talk to them and ask them very politely to stop turning off the switch that says, do not turn off the switch. What a mess I've got myself into. It's all good fun though. Looking at the other comments here, Craig, hoping to migrate from Home Bridge to Home Assistant as Harmony Hub integration is flaky for me. So I had someone else suggesting Home Bridge to me during the week as well. And look, I have seen mention of Home Bridge, but I kind of went to the, and someone sort of said, why did you choose Home Assistant over Home Bridge? And I basically said, because no one's talking about Home Bridge, not by comparison. Home Assistant has enormous community support. As an entire ecosystem, and then all of these different sort of sub ecosystems within there have got enormous community support as well. So clearly this is where the love is going, and that's the reason why I'm focusing on it. So I don't know what I'd get out of Home Bridge that I don't already get out of Home Assistant. Christian is back on beer. I wonder if it could be the Hansa Mango IPA. No, it's not. But you know the good thing about iPhones, and I'll talk about the bad thing about iPhones later as well, because I did have some issues this week, which is this week's blog post, is that you can go into your photos and you can search for like beer. 123 photos of beer. Now, somewhere in here, there may well be, there's me drinking beer, Charlotte drinking beer, Scott drinking beer, but I can't find the photo of the beer that I like so much in Norway. Where is it? I will find it. Actually, this one was cool. Old man yells at cloud, and it's just like Grandpa Simpson shaking his fist. Kind of feels like me sometimes trying to fix my Azures. No, these Azures are fine. Don't worry about them. Anyway, I'll find the beer for Christian. Stefan has just realized we have spiders in Australia. Yeah, we do. What else is going on? Jason, hi from Toowoomba. Toowoomba was on my – so I'm looking at places that I want to go during lockdown and particularly during school holidays and things. And Toowoomba was one of the places that popped up. Most people listening to this probably got no idea where it is. It's like northwest from here. It's inland Queensland. But part of the planning Charlotte and I were just doing, thinking about where we want to go for things like New Year's Eve, when I was mentioning Stavanger before. I'll talk more about that later on. In fact, inevitably, at my holidays at the end of the year, we'll be in some other places. And I think I'm going to end up doing some of these from some pretty outback, unusual places, which will be fun. Tom, have you tried Untappd to record your beers? Yes, and I tend to record just one of them at a time. And I accept friends who I know that I've drunken beer with, because I get a lot of rando requests that I don't necessarily want to share my locations and check-ins with. So, yeah, no apologies. Oh, sorry. Apologies if I don't accept random requests. Paul, if you can figure out how to force the Ubiquiti topology map to refresh, correct, I'd like to know. Mine is wrong since I put in a new PoE switch. Every time I load it, it seems to update because inevitably, I've got a lot of devices. I think I figured out I've got about 90-something IP addresses in the house now between clients and access points and switches and things. And they do tend to roam around. Certainly, the wireless clients roam around. So my topology updates, not necessarily in real time. I think, do I have to reload it or does it update while I'm looking at it? Let's answer that question right now. If I open that up, and in fact, the blog post I'm going to talk about today, I do have a screen cap of my network topology. And for those not familiar with Ubiquiti, the network topology is basically everything that is in your network and what is connected to what. So this will load up in a moment, but my iPhone is inevitably talking wirelessly to an access point somewhere. Now, it might be the access point that's sitting about 2 meters over there. That would be the logical thing. But it might also be the one that's immediately under me, because Wi-Fi and radio waves and things like this can be a little bit unpredictable. So I'm looking at my network topology map. And here's what's actually kind of cool. So my iPhone, I can see on the topology map, has got a dashed line, which means Wi-Fi, through to the access point, which is called Troy's office. That then has a solid line, so it's a physical connection, through to the UniFi Switch 8 PoE 150 watt, which then has a solid line through to the UniFi Switch 24 PoE, which is down in the network cabinet, which is inside the wine cupboard, which is inside the garage, which then has a solid line through to the UniFi Dream Machine Pro, and that's where the map ends, because then it goes WAN out into the modem. So it's pretty cool to see all that in the topology, and I'm just going to leave it here, but I'm pretty sure that this does update in real time, at least for me. If you're having problems, one of the things I've found is that the Ubiquiti forums are really active, really well supported, and there's a lot of good folks on there. So you could always ask there. All right. Other questions in here. Where else are we all? I can see mine refresh wireless clients, but not wired ones so much, even if I restart them. I do find there's some flakiness here, and I have fed this back to Ubiquiti. I do have people in Ubiquiti that I speak to quite a bit. Very generous people who send me Ubiquiti bits. And one of the pieces of feedback I've given to them is sometimes I see things like my Apple Watch hardwired, as in a physical connection, RJ45 Ethernet cable sort of thing, into my Dream Machine Pro. And I was like, mate, I don't have a plug on this. Like, this is not wired in. But sometimes it does get a little bit flaky there. I haven't seen it happen for a while, actually. But I don't think these diagrams are perfect, these network maps. The other piece of feedback I've given is that I would love to see a way of exporting the topology map, because mine, first of all, is epic, and second of all, I can't actually export it without scrolling the entire screen. And even using screen capture stuff like Snagit, which can normally scroll, this doesn't seem to want to actually scroll and capture, which is a bit of a shame, because this network map is super, super cool. So that's that bit. What else we got in the list here before I move on to some other things? Good morning from Brussels. Ah, Brussels. Speaking of beer, I had a lot of nice trips to Brussels in the past. Let me go on to some other things, though. Chrome and the Omnibox. Oh, boy, people lost their minds over this. And I knew that they were going to get upset, which is why I was rubbing my hands so much when I tweeted it. There's a word for it when you take just a little bit of pleasure out of watching people lose their minds. And I knew it was going to happen. And so here's the context, and there's some good rationale behind this as well. So Chrome is often trying new approaches to visual indicators. So Chrome was very much the first browser to be very overt around things like insecure connections, around mixed content, around things like you have an input box on the page and this page is served insecurely, therefore we're going to say not secure. So they've been pretty much at the forefront of that. Mozilla's been very close behind. But very often it's Chrome. And of course, Chrome has the lion's share of the browser audience as well. So everyone does pay attention to what they do. And one of the things that the folks at Google have been focusing on a lot is how do you provide meaningful visual indicators to people that allow them to make sensible decisions? So a good example of this is they killed off extended validation before anyone else. Now, to be clear, extended validation certificates still work. They killed off the visual indicator because people didn't understand what it meant. It provided no value. I've got multiple blog posts around how stupid EV was in the first place. But Chrome was inevitably the first browser to kill that off, and then everyone just followed. So what they've done now, and they're not the first to do this, this is what's kind of interesting, is in Chrome 86, I'll give you a good example. I'm looking at my unified topology map at the moment, and the domain name is unify.ui.com, and then it's like /device, and then there's a massive freaking GUID, /network, /site, /default, /maps, /topologies, basically all this crap off the end of it. So what Google is experimenting with a sample audience in Chrome 86, is hiding everything after the domain. Now, Google's been tweaking what is up there in the Omnibox, as they call it. It's not an address bar because it does other things as well. They've been tweaking this for some time. So they've been doing things like not showing the scheme. People started losing their minds with that. Remember a little while ago, it must have been about 18 months ago, they took away the www. And in fact, they reverted that because people completely lost their minds over that. So anyway, I tweet this little video, which is my laptop updated and was obviously part of the sample set to see how this behavior sat with people. And I tweeted a little video where I'm just going through my blog post and I'm clicking on links. And as I drill down into a page, an individual blog post, the Omnibox still says troyhunt.com. It doesn't show the path. And holy shit, the feedback on that. People went berserk. And the thing is that, I'm going to say something a bit less a bit more disingenuous than what I will say. People are very, we are all shaped by our own experiences. So everyone is commenting from their experiences and their views, perhaps forgetting that Google is making a browser that is used by the masses. And in terms of the comprehension level of the masses, you've got everyone else that has like this level of comprehension, and then you've got my audience, which is at the completely different end of the scale because they're developers and they're security people and they're folks who do actually pay attention to what's in the address bar. So what was really fun about this, fun to watch about this, is people losing their minds because they're saying, if you take away the path, it's going to be harder for people to spot phishing attacks. Now, this frankly doesn't make much sense for a number of reasons. And again, remember, we're talking about the masses here. Anyone can turn this back on, by the way. Like if you're part of the sample set, you right-click the address bar and, in fact, even on my PC, you can say, always show full URLs, and you'll see the whole thing. So it's an easy, easy rollback if you don't like it. But when someone is faced with a long URL, the type that I'm seeing here on the Unify dashboard, it's really, really hard to actually interpret that and form meaningful decisions about the trustworthiness of the site. Particularly when we're talking about phishing sites, it's easy for phishing sites to obfuscate content. It's not like you're going to a phishing site and the domain looks innocent And then the path is like, we hack you now. Like, this is not what they do. If they really want to obfuscate the content, the path will look very inane. So everything that happens after the domain name is kind of like, if they want to, they're going to obfuscate it to the point where it's not going to be clearly malicious to anyone anyway. So Google's position is, if we can simplify the contents of the address bar and people can focus on what Google believes, and this is just their belief, they're trying to test it as part of this experiment. If people can just focus on the domain name, which is the thing which is more likely to indicate trustworthiness or not, then that is a better net result. Now, look, I can see both arguments here. I'm a little bit more inclined to lean towards the side of I don't think that normal people need the entire URL. But I also understand, even for me personally, I've kind of left the full URL on my PC, but just the domain name on my laptop, and it's bugging me. But I'm also a sort of person who's going to look for this. So we'll see. Now, what I found quite funny is people who said, like, this is Google trying to take over the web or exert their force over everyone else. Google's trying to change everything. And as a few people said pretty quickly, they're like, you know, Safari's been doing this for ages, right? It was like Apple has already done this. And then if you pick up a mobile device, certainly Safari on iOS only shows the host name. And it was funny, actually, because I made a point of that. It's in my thread, and I'll link to that thread when I put the notes in this episode. And I made the point in the thread, and someone said, oh, yeah, but that's a mobile device. You're limited by screen real estate. And it's kind of like, well, so we're acknowledging that a lot of the time people don't see the entire path anyway. We know that a huge portion of mobile of browsing, full stop, is on mobile devices. So if people aren't used to seeing it anyway, well, what's the point? Anyway, we'll see. This is the joy of this A/B testing, and I hope that Google provides a lot of information about what they find. I did add to my thread a piece of information, a blog post that Google wrote about this. I pinged Emily Schechter from the Google team, who is an amazingly smart person in terms of the work she's done of looking at people's behaviors and how real-world humans, not techie people like you and I, actually respond to things. And I know that they're putting a lot of research into this. So even if I'm not completely on board with the position, I know that they've thought about it more than me and that there's good reasons why they're going down that path. All righty. Look at some of the other comments here. Pradeep, good morning from Singapore. So fun fact, I lived in Singapore for about 3 years when I was a kid. So I would really like to get back to Singapore. This was actually one of my plans this year. I wanted to do less travel and try and stay more locally. So I was planning to go back to Singapore around the middle of the year, but it did not happen this time. So when I can, and there will be a time, hopefully we can do a user group or something like that as well. What else we got in here while we grab some more beer? Lots of discussion. All right. Someone made a point here, last comment at the moment. I agree, normal users won't care. I think I could fairly safely ask my mum and dad how they felt about the recent Google Chrome change, and they wouldn't have a clue what I was talking about. Now, maybe that means they also don't get the value out of the change. I don't know. But I don't think that it's actually going to have any impact whatsoever on the normies. Burton, what do you think of the new iPhone? I think I'm waiting, what's the time now, 6 p.m. At 11 p.m., which is going to be after my bedtime, I can buy it. So I want the 5G. Look at iPhones, business deductions, their tools that help me do the job. The faster they go, the better. I lament a little bit, and I think many people have lamented for many years now, that we see new phone releases, and for the last, what, since probably like, when was the last time we had a new iPhone release and we went, wow, this is like revolutionary? iPhone 4? That was pretty revolutionary. Maybe when we went to Face ID, when was that, iPhone 8-ish? So we're seeing new releases which aren't exactly setting the world on fire, but everything is a positive incremental step forward. I'll tell you the thing that I didn't know was coming. Like, I knew there was going to be 5G. The thing I didn't know was coming that I think was actually going to be really cool is the magnetic sort of suction, not suction, but thing on the back. What do they call it? Mag Circle or something like that. Oh, man, it's going to drive me nuts now. And I'll tell you why I think that's pretty cool. So I've got a bunch of wireless chargers around the house. In fact, I'll show you this one because the bloody thing's broken and doesn't work very well. It's an Anker. Now, see, this one's fine because the joy of this one is that you can't stuff it up. And what I mean by that is that the phone always sits there and it charges. Now, the problem is this one doesn't charge, but that's not because of the design of it. There's something else that's gone wrong. There's an Anker charger. But both Charlotte and I have got these flat ones next to the bed. So you put the Apple Watch on it, and then you sit the iPhone on it like this, and they do the wireless charging. But if they're not perfectly centered, then it doesn't work. And so many times we've gotten up, and I think it's her in particular where she's like, my phone has got no battery because it hasn't sat perfectly. So it's MagSafe. I've just opened up the Apple site. So MagSafe is basically like a circular magnetic space on the back where you will then be able to get chargers where it does sort of click into position just like the watch does for those who've got an Apple Watch. And I think that's awesome for cases where the phone lays flat. When they sit up like this, it's hard to stuff it up because it sits right there anyway. So that's really cool. And then the other thing that I didn't realize initially when I first saw it is that there will be aftermarket things like phone chargers, which can magnetically sit on with the phone. So rather than having like a third-party mount where you put like one of those little metal plates behind the cover, which I've done before, this will actually be a native magnet in the device and a native magnet then on some compatible car mount, and it sits like that. The number of times I have had phones just go flying off mounts in cars, and yes, it may also be because of the type of car and the way I drive them as well, but it has driven me absolutely nuts. So I really like the idea of having a native mounting system that still gives you the flexibility to have whatever case you want and things like that. So we'll see what that looks like. So, Bert and I do intend to buy the new one, and we'll see what it looks like. I think there's a little bit of me too with things like cameras. There are so many moments in my life, particularly with kids, where I just want to capture like the best representation of that moment as I possibly can. And as we get these incremental upgrades on each edition of phones, it's like I can make that memory just that little bit crisper and that little bit clearer. And I can do it in a tax effective way as well, which is important. All right. So just reading the comments here, Apple Watch 6. Yeah, it's on order. it's coming. So, I skipped 5 because it's like, I don't think there's a lot happening there. Charlotte's got 5. It still lights when she puts her hand down, which seems kind of cool, but this is something that I use massively extensively, partly because I've been closing my exercise rings for about 200 days in a row now, closing all the rings for about 200 days in a row now, so that my exercise and fitness is a really big part of it. I think the O2 sensor will be super cool. Again, this fits into the tax deductibility realm as well, which is a nice thing to do. So I think actually the phone will come first because it looks like phone delivery times are like 1 week after ordering, and the watch is still sometime in November, as best I can tell. So Tom's commenting, oh, yes, magnetic chargers and accessories. Yes, there's going to be a whole other accessory range here now as well to deal with, which is fun. You know, accessory makers got to make money, right? Tom says Leadfoot. Next comment. Would be interested in what devices is Shiny Dog. Would be interested in what devices you use as your Zigbee hub. So the Zigbee hub I'm using, incidentally, Shiny Dog, the B in Zigbee is meant to be small now. And the other reason I know that is because I am a stickler for detail and things like that. And when I was writing this blog series, I keep seeing like little B and big B. Which one is it? So apparently they transitioned from a big B to a little B a little while ago. Just like Cloudflare transitioned from a big F to a little F. But in answer to your question, I'm using a Conbi 2 Zigbee sniffer. So that's in the blog series I'm writing too. That works really nicely with all the Foscon and Decons stuff as well. And again, that will be in the blog post, which I must get finished. Stefan, I saw a charging mat a while ago. I think it was Xiaomi. that would align the charging coils to perfectly be under the device to be charged with small motors, I think. Crazy. Well, that's pretty cool. I like the magnet idea. I still think that's a really, really clever idea. Right about here, someone tells me Android's been doing that for ages. And I don't know how an operating system aligns magnets, but I'm sure someone will tell me that it's been doing it for ages anyway. All right. So actually, let me rant about something else. Now that we're talking about phones and cars. So just noticed Nick 007 agreed my phone flew off my windscreen mount and hit me on the freeway. Wasn't fun. No, that doesn't sound like very much fun. I do love cars and I love driving and I'm really, really conscious about the safety aspect. And I hate the premise of something being loose in the car and possibly falling off into your lap or under your feet. And I think that there's a lot of risk in a lot of these phone mounts. Now, the path I was going to go down, I feel this is almost blog worthy, is in my GTR, because it's old now, it's literally a 10-year-old car, it's got like USB sockets so I can plug it in and I can play music over that and I can, you know, Bluetooth, that sort of thing, but no CarPlay. The Mercedes has CarPlay, which is great, except it's an absolute freaking nightmare. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I'll be at the shops today, perfect example. I'm at the shops buying my new hat and I walk back to the car, open up Google Maps. Here's the place I would like to go to next. Now I know where I'm going, but I like putting it in Google Maps because if there's traffic or something, it can route you around there. Do all that, get in the car. And a lot of the time, it doesn't connect properly. So I'm literally like USBing straight into the bottom of this because Mercedes has to physically connect. The BMWs can CarPlay wirelessly. So I've plugged it in. A lot of the time it doesn't connect. So then you're sitting there somewhere in the traffic trying to replug in your phone, which other than being dangerous is also, if someone else was to do it who wasn't me, that would be illegal because you're not allowed to touch the phone. So there's that. And then I'll put in the map and then the map will come up like on the display in the car, which is great, but it will just be frozen. You'll be stuck there and you're driving along going, la, 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 you know, everything's fine. I don't have to turn or anything. But the map's actually frozen and you're just driven right past your turn. And the only way to fix it is you got to pick the phone up. Your passenger has to pick the phone up and unlock it. So you've got to give them the PIN or you've got to look over at the phone while you face ID your way into it. And then when you unlock it and you're on Google Maps, then it all lines up again. And I just constantly find it is flaky, 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 flaky to the point where I honestly think it's more dangerous using CarPlay that is unreliable than having the phone like on a holder somewhere there and being able to touch it. Now, depending on where you are in the world, you may or may not be able to touch the phone and use the GPS and the media player if it is mounted somewhere physically. You may or may not be able to even pick it up in your hand. Either way, I don't like the idea of technology which is not working the way you expect whilst you're driving like a 2-ton freaking missile down the freeway. Glad I got that off my chest. All right. other questions that are here. What else we got here? Do your IoT devices have internet access or have you blocked it? Yes. Depends what it is. So here's the paradox. I don't want other people opening my door or turning on my lights or accessing my cameras or doing anything like that. There are certain things that I do want to be able to do remotely, though, and they include at least two of the previous things I just mentioned. So one of them is I do want to be able to open my garage door remotely. And for new listeners, I have two garage doors. I have one which actually goes into an internal space where I have bikes and wakeboards and things like that, and that is not connected. And then there's like an external carport door, which you could just kind of jump the fence and get to anyway, and that one is connected. And I want to be able to open that remotely because I want delivery people to be able to drop things in there. I've got a camera that looks at it, a Ubiquiti camera. I want to be able to access that remotely so when I'm not at home, I can see if there's been any events or I can see if something has been left there and if I should shut the door. So that's great. Now, there's those scenarios where I do want to be able to do things remotely, but then something like the lights, I cannot think at the moment of a sufficiently good use case where I'd want the lights externally exposed. So the Shellys, which control my lights, I've disabled the cloud component. So you can control them via Shelly Cloud. I've turned that off. Obviously, the Ubiquiti stuff, externally accessible. The garage door, which is ultimately a Shelly controlled by Home Assistant, that Home Assistant component is externally accessible via Nabucasa. And this, again, will be in the big blog series. And that also integrates with HomeKit on my watch so that I can physically just push the button on the watch. So I find that I'm continually trying to juggle this balance of I want to be able to do some things remotely, but I don't want to take the risk of other people doing them remotely. Like, what is the right middle ground? So what I'm doing is just turning off things that have remote capabilities natively in the device and deferring back to doing it via Home Assistant, but that still does create a risk. And then the question is, how do you mitigate the risk? So a good example is I point the cameras at places which are publicly observable only. So there are no cameras like here in the kids' room or in the living room or anything like that. Like, no matter how messed up stuff gets, no one's going to see something that they couldn't see anyway by, at worst, like doing this over the fence kind of thing. Ubiquiti also has privacy zones, so you can edit the camera view and put black boxes over certain areas. So one of the cameras has a view that partly sort of covers a window in the master bedroom. I just put a big black box over it, and that's literally recorded onto the video. So if anyone pulls the video later on and I've gotten up insufficiently attired and opened the curtain, you know, like that's just going to be all, you know, blacked out. So I think it's a calculated risk. How's that for an answer? Yeah, other questions here. So Stefan's got a 2020 BMW 5 Series wireless CarPlay. Absolutely stunning, especially with touchscreen. So this is one of the other problems. In my E63S, I don't have touchscreen. And even though I've had the car 2 years, the other day I was literally like, I wonder if I can move the thing. Because in my mind, I'm so used to just touching things on the screen. So the newer generation Mercedes do have touchscreens. I'm just, yeah, a little bit too early on that one. Quarterfed. CarPlay is great when it works. It's just everything you're saying. It's driving me mad. Same issues with Waze. I did turn on the Batmobile feature of Waze the other day, so that was my big achievement. I was very happy with that. The kids are going to love that when they see that, which is good. Tom, BT CarPlay is magic. Work has Hyundai Konas with BT CarPlay, so good. And I mean, this is the joy of it. I remember when CarPlay first launched and the adoption was really, really low, and it was like Ferrari has adopted it. So, well, that's going to make a big difference to humanity, isn't it? But ultimately, it's cheap chipsets and software that does filter through into everything. So I think it's super cool that and Google's equivalent as well are now becoming standard. And it's particularly cool that you can bring your device to your car, and the car, which is something that, let's say in the case of my GTR, I've had for 10 years now, is going to outlast, you know, many, many different versions of the phone, but the capability comes from the phone itself. It's a little bit like, I don't like the idea of smart TVs. I do like the idea of an Apple TV because I can keep the big expensive flat screen and then I can just flick out the little smart device that plugs into it over HDMI. Someone says, here, get your Mercedes, deal at a factory, reset your head unit. Okay, maybe that's an idea. I might ask for that next time in there. All right, let me talk about the next thing on my list here, which was the blog post of the week, which was not planned in any way. So occasionally I have a blog post where I really haven't thought about doing anything, and then something just scratches that itch, you know, or creates that itch that I have to scratch with a blog post. So this was customized Ubiquiti clients and randomized MAC addresses on Apple devices. And just before, we're talking about Ubiquiti network maps. And if you go to my blog and you look at the most recent blog post, the first image in there is a Ubiquiti network topology map. And it looks really cool because it's got all the right icons. It's like my Raspberry Pis have Raspberry Pi icons and my Shelly IoT things have Shelly icons. And they all join up right, and then they got the right names. And it's lovely. I love looking at it and seeing what has connected where and how the whole network works. And to my dismay, I noticed very recently that a number of my Apple devices and Charlotte's Apple devices were no longer showing the right icon and no longer showing the right name. And it upset me greatly because, as I mentioned before, I'm a detail person with this sort of stuff. I want it to be right, and I'd put a lot of effort into making it right. And on a hunch, I took a screen cap of a whole bunch of Apple devices, their device name, their IP address, and their Mac address as well. Because what I'd been doing is I'd been going into my Ubiquiti setup, clicking on a device, naming it, giving it an icon, Bob's your uncle, everyone's happy. And I was sort of thinking, okay, well, how does Ubiquiti identify the device? Well, it's probably going to be Mac address because that's the unique identifier of the device. Now, as of iOS 14, Apple has decided, and I think this is a good decision to be clear, that it is going to generate different unique MAC addresses per network that you connect to. And the rationale here is that because MAC addresses are unique identifiers, if someone with the same MAC address moves between different networks, you could track their movements. Now, I think the idea that they've had here where they've said, okay, well, look, let's, each time you connect to a different network, we're going to randomize the MAC address. We're going to generate a new one. I think this is good in terms of the privacy side of things. In the blog post, I linked to a story I saw years ago, which is about rubbish bins in London. This is back in 2013, tracking MAC addresses. Because as you walk past, if you're connected to that network, it'll go, oh, look, it's this MAC address. This is, and depending on what other activity can correlate to it, but it's either going to say, hey, this is Troy. He walked past here every day at like 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, we can start to correlate his behavior. And then if you go somewhere else and it's the same network provider or someone with access to the same data and they send the same MAC address, they can start to join all of these dots. And from a privacy perspective, not so good. So Apple has started randomizing these. And that there is a little nuance here that I'm still not completely convinced about, where as of iOS 14 or watchOS 7, and all of this hit, when was it, about 6 weeks ago, there's a little nuance, which is, does the address randomize within the same network, or is the address static per network and you just get a different address for each network you connect to? Now, I linked to a news article which suggests that the address changes periodically even on the same network, which would explain the behavior that I've been seeing. But then Apple's documentation suggests that each time you connect to a new network, then you get a new address, which would not explain my behavior unless it's because I have multiple SSIDs and I connected to like the IoT network at one time and I got a different MAC address and that didn't recognize it from the MAC address on the primary network. But then Charlotte's devices are doing the same thing and she's only on the primary network. So I don't know. But regardless, what you can do is on a per network basis, what's the right term here? You can turn off like the privacy feature, which kind of sounds worse than what it is. Here we go, private address. So there's a little toggle here, which I've toggled off in my home network. I've toggled off private address, which means I should always have the same Wi-Fi address, which I believe is the native MAC address of the network adapter in the device for this network. And then if I connect to like my IoT network and I've still got it toggled off, I should still have the same MAC address and it should still match. And then if the theory about them rotating the MAC address periodically, even on the same network is true, this should fix that as well. And there are multiple other things which stem off this, which people alluded to in the comments and also came up in some of the research. So for example, what if you're doing MAC address filtering? So there was a time many, many years ago where on my network, because I was being a security zealot, I went, not only do you need to know the SSID, which was not publicly broadcast, but you can kind of discover it anyway, and you need to have the WPA2 password, but I'm also going to filter on MAC address. So unless I have literally put your MAC address in an allow list, you cannot connect. And then I realized that was a real pain in the ass to maintain. But the point here is that if people are using MAC addresses to try and filter good ones, known ones from bad ones, and then Apple's rotating them, then that does kind of create a little bit of an issue. But if they don't do that, then you have the privacy issue. So I think the TLDR and the easy answer here is that if it's important for you to identify a client across multiple connections and particularly across multiple networks, then for each of those networks, you just turn off the privacy on the MAC address. If it's your own home, it's like you're broadcasting the host name anyway. If it says Troy's iPhone, it's like, well, that really narrows it down. Who could it possibly be here? We don't then need to try and obfuscate the MAC address. So home networks, I would turn that off if you want to be able to correlate activity based on a MAC address or assign things like icons and fun names to it. Outside the home network, I think it's actually good. And I like the idea of not broadcasting the same unique identifier to multiple different networks. Okay, that was a bit wordy. All right, I think we're pretty much up to speed with comments and things like this here as well. I did notice there's a couple here from SK. Don't mean externally accessible either. Can the Wi-Fi devices make internet requests to, for example, firmware update servers or potentially less innocuous sites? Now, this brings me to the stats that I've been seeing on my Pi-hole. So Pi-hole, for those of you who are not up to speed with it, is a DNS resolver. It is usually run on a Raspberry Pi. You configure it your network layer to resolve DNS to the Pi-hole. The Pi-hole then either black holes the query if you're querying a DNS, which is a known tracker, telemetry address, malware, this sort of thing. Or if it's not that, then it passes that DNS query onto a DNS server of your choice, such as Cloudflare's 1.1.1.1. Now, when I look at the queries that have been going through my Pi-hole, man, IoT is massive in here. The number one requested domain by a significant margin is api.shelly.cloud, which confounds me because I have turned off the remote administration facility or cloud accessible piece. And without sort of drilling down at all now, when I looked at it last time, it looked like there was one particular Shelly, and I think it might be the one on my garage door because I configured that a bit differently, which every second was making a DNS query. The one after that is Tuya. Now, Tuya does a lot of the downlights that I have, particularly in the kids' rooms. So that's number two. So in the last 24 hours, there's been 24,602 DNS requests to api.shelly.cloud, 15,500 to the two-year one. Within the top 10, if I scroll down a little bit, myharmony.com. So I have a Harmony remote control for the TV. Down a little bit further, and the rest of these are things like office domains and things like that. So it's kind of interesting to see how much activity is going out. Now, I haven't gone through and profiled any traffic in terms of what happens after the DNS request is made. What does it actually do? But it is an interesting question. So it would be curious, actually, if I was to take something like the Shelly domain and just chuck it on a blacklist. Does stuff still work? Maybe we should do that. Maybe we should just block it all together and then see what happens. We'll see. We'll see. I'm just not convinced that everything is still going to work the way I expected it to. All right. So hopefully that answers the question, SK. You've also then continued and said, does the Xiaomi Shelly Wi-Fi device connect to some server and open a reverse shell? Geez, I hope not. Or have you blocked them from reaching the internet? So clearly they can reach the internet. I guess one thing was something that is so ubiquitously used as Shelly and Xiaomi, if they are doing dodgy stuff, someone is going to pick it up. And this almost feels like a bit of a weak argument. It's like, yeah, someone will figure it out before something bad happens. That's not the intention. I think what I mean here is that this is something which is really easily observable. If it goes rogue at some point, you'd kind of expect that to be seen. There's another discussion about, should I just be VLANing this off? I do have separate networks for IoT. There's an IoT network versus a primary network that my PC and my phone suffer on. But VLANs are really problematic with IoT. I had one on my previous generation Ubiquiti network. I've carried over the unique Wi-Fi names. I haven't VLANed them yet on the new network. I may not because it does cause so many problems. All right, other comments here. Nick 007, this is a good idea, but surely it is a pain for enterprise networks that use MAC addresses to identify that they are valid. I think what's a bit different with enterprise is that very often enterprise owns not just the network, but the device as well. Now, if they own the device, then they can configure it not to randomize the MAC address. So I'm not sure that the arguments I've heard about enterprise being able to filter based on MAC address are entirely relevant. I think that is addressable, pardon the pun, in different ways. Stephen, MAC filtering is inefficient, not effective. MACs can be spoofed too. Well, exactly. I mean, this is entirely what iOS 14 does. It spoofs MAC addresses. This is not the native MAC address that's being broadcast by the device. It's like it's literally just making it up as it goes. Burton, Windows 10 should do this with randomized addresses. Now, apparently Windows does, but it is off by default. You need to turn it on because part of the discussion is someone said, like, you know, Windows does this too. And I sort of went, well, I've never seen this. And I would notice because I must look at my Ubiquiti map every single day. And I've never seen a Windows machine drop off. But apparently you can turn it on. And I think it is then just on a per network basis. It can generate or spoof a new MAC address. Okay, Marcus, you got me interested in Shellys and now I'm researching. Which ones are you finding the best? So I'm using Shelly ones at the moment. I don't need any dimming capability. I don't need any power monitoring capability. I just want a relay, which can be turned on or off. And the Shelly ones are the cheapest for that. So I must have about a dozen in the house at the moment. If you look at that last blog post, you can count them because they're all on the network map. So they've been pretty good. And I'll write more about those when I do that blog series on IoT as well. And I think the final comment here, Marcus makes a really good point. Enterprises have MDM stuff working too. So they've got mobile device management, which is the sort of thing which allows them to control the device itself and the configuration on it, which I imagine would include things like whether or not you actually have privacy on your MAC address and randomize it. All right, folks, look, I think we're about done. They are almost at an hour and I'm almost out of beer as well. So I think I'm done for this week. Thank you for watching. Next week, I'll come back in the morning at coffee o'clock instead of beer o'clock. And I hope everyone has an awesome rest of their Friday or rest of their weekend, depending on where you are. Thanks, everyone. See you later.